Russians will head to the polls beginning today as a country's presidential election kicked off amid international scrutiny and domestic complexities. No one is expected to come out on top after the rubber stamp election, but President Vladimir Putin, who's poised to become the longest serving Russian leader since Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union. What does Putin's all-but-certain victory mean to Russia, the world, and the ongoing war in Ukraine? For further insights, we now connect with Professor Nina Tumarkin, a professor of Slavic Studies and History at Wellesley College. She's also the director of Russian Area Studies at Wellesley. Thank you so much for joining us, and good morning from
Seoul. Thank you for having me. Hi.
Hello. It is a pleasure to have you. Jumping into the deep end of this poll, Dr. Tumarkin, we're looking at another 6 years for Putin. And so the big question we want to start out with, how did he rise to power? This is as we head into the elections, no opposition figures are allowed to run against Vladimir Putin. Can you tell our listeners how Putin first rose to power, how he was able to reign over Russia, the largest state in the world, for so long?
Yes, I certainly can. But I would like to, as an historian, make a preliminary statement. And that statement is that in all of Russia's history, all of it, Russians have never had the opportunity to elect their leader. This is very important, certainly not in the Soviet period, when a leader's death was then met by a succession, a power struggle, or a coup. As there was after Khrushchev died and Brezhnev took over, President Yeltsin, after Gorbachev, really came to power also in a coup, in a deal that he worked out with the leaders of Ukraine and the Belarusian Republic at the time, former Belarus. And Putin was handpicked by Yeltsin to be acting president. And then there was really no opposition when he actually won by a landslide in 2000. There's never been opposition. So it's important, you know, not to just think, well, he'll win this election because there's no opposition. I think it's important to know that in hundreds and hundreds of years, they've never been able to elect a leader as a historical context. That said, moving on to how it is that he rose to power. It's obviously a pretty complicated story. It's important to note that he took advantage of the very tumultuous and difficult decade of the 1990s under President Yeltsin, and particularly the second term of President Yeltsin that began in 1996, when the economy was really collapsing. In 1998, the ruble actually truly had a collapse. There was widespread dissension, crime, corruption, poverty. And he, as the named head of the FSB, which was the successor to the KGB. I'm sure you all know that he had started out his career as a KGB operative, made his way first in Leningrad politics and then moving to Moscow and currying favor, gaining favor with important people and gaining the trust of President Boris Yeltsin, as Yeltsin himself was ailing, was alcoholic, and looking for somebody younger, strong, sober, somebody that he could trust. It was very important that it would be somebody that he could trust, that when he, Yeltsin, would resign, he would be guaranteed to be free from prosecution for all the crimes that he had committed when he was president of Russia. And Putin had a history and practice of being very loyal to those above him. It's also important to note in Putin's biography that there was a very lively and contentious, in the best way, period between 1885 and 1990, during the period of Mikhail Gorbachev, who was head of the Communist Party and then also became president. Their famous household words of perestroika and glasnost, the voicing of criticism, the end of censorship. There was really kind of a free reign to a certain extent. There was a freely elected parliament in 1989, not for a leader, but a parliament. And there was a new culture of different points of view, different political parties. And it's important to note that Vladimir Putin in those 5 years wasn't in Russia. Mm-hmm. He missed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. He was in Dresden in East Germany, acting as a KGB operative in a very almost Stalinist regime in East Germany at the time. Mm-hmm. So he missed that whole history of debate and consensus and confrontation and accepting other points of view. That was very important also. Mm-hmm. And then once he got into power as acting president, as he was named on New Year's Eve, he was named acting president. He had been first prime minister, then acting president. And then he was elected in the spring of 2000 and served a 4-year term till 2004, another 4-year term till 2008. Then there was the famous flip, mm-hmm. where he and his prime minister Medvedev changed places, and Medvedev was president. Mm-hmm. Putin was prime minister, but still leader. Meanwhile, the constitution was changed. Mm-hmm. President's term is 6 years. So he was elected till 2018 and then till 2024 for 2 6-year terms. And the constitution was again changed, taking away the limit of 2 terms so that he's now, of course, will be elected. And if he lives and stays in power, he'll remain in power till 2030 and could run again and stay in power till 2036. Mm. It's really important to understand that one of the ways that he, when you say maintained his grip on power, a lot of it actually can be summed up in 3 letters, OIL. The price of oil went up between 2000 and 2008 steadily. And from a very wobbly and shaky economy, he managed to turn the economy around and bring real prosperity and rise in the standard of living for many people, maybe not in all rural areas, but certainly for many people. Mm. So that was very, very important to his hold on power. He was very shaken in 2011 when there were massive protests, as many as 100,000 people out on the streets to protest rigging of parliamentary elections, and then even also protests before his re-election in 2012. Mm-hmm. And after that, a new regime came in. Mm-hmm. That first regime, the Putin era of the first maybe 4 years, even 8 years, was, I wouldn't say liberal, but it was certainly quasi-democratic. Okay. They weren't just forms. There were political parties. There was more or less a somewhat free press. I mean, there were various television stations and radio stations that were allowed to operate. People did take to the streets to protest at various times. Mm. This changed drastically in 2012. After those protests. By the way, Putin blamed Hillary Clinton for those protests, Secretary of State, completely baseless. And then a much more conservative and strict regime came in, although it was still far, far cry from the truly harsh, now really autocratic proto-police state that you see in Russia today.
Dr. Tumarkin, because we're so limited on time, I think I want to head on to our second question today. We understand that Putin wants to remain in power. This is why he changed the constitution, and he's very adamant about this. But the bigger question is, for what? What does Vladimir Putin want?
Well, I think In his quarter century in power, he's pursued two goals. The first has been to create a vast machinery of repression, eliminating any domestic forces that oppose him or that have the potential to do so. And it's entailed the murder of journalists, the arrest of oligarchs, the persecution of any viable political alternatives. Everybody knows about the shocking death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny just recently. I think his main goal, as you say, well, what are the real goals about remaining in power? I think he has a goal to deprive most Russians of the ability to imagine a future without him. The idea that it's impossible to counter him today, it'll be impossible to counter him tomorrow. He's no longer hemmed in by a parliament, a constitution, or an opposition. He's really at the height of his power. Mm. And for a minority of people, this induces despair or rage. For many other people, there's a sense of stability. What are his other goals? It's important for him that Russia should be and remain a major player on the world stage without having to adhere to the rules-based order. It's important that the former Soviet space be considered in his bailiwick, in his sphere of influence. And that's why this fear of NATO and the despair and anger on his part at the expansion of NATO moving ever eastward is so difficult for them. He does not have a goal of putting back the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. of putting that together. I would say that's not the case. Major player on the world stage, and that the world should allow him to do what he wants with the former Soviet space.
I want to skip along to our fourth question today, just because we're crunched on time. And the big question here is based on what Russian opposition activists are saying and also critics, is Putin's regime running out of fuel? Some say that Putin's power is weakening and the system he built is becoming more fragile. He won't lose the election, but his grip on power could be weakened. And they point to actually the death of Navalny as one of the major reasons, and the death of Wagner chief Prigozhin as proof. So what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, my thoughts, first of all, the death of Navalny. I actually am in a minority of Russia specialists who I believe that he was not murdered outright. I mean, that certainly Navalny's murder began from the moment he was incarcerated in that horrible Arctic prison under such harsh conditions. But I do not think that Putin or the Kremlin ordered at this time that his that Navalny should be killed, because of they could predict what would happen. I mean, it was bad for them to have people on the street protesting. Everybody saw that. Everybody saw all the mourners come. Mm-hmm. They saw the mourners being arrested just for leaving flowers. So I don't think that the death of Navalny is proof of weakness. It is true that you could say, why is it so important that he gets, why is it so important to him to get very very high numbers in the election when there's really no opposition? And why is he so keen to have no opponents? I mean, Alexei Navalny always in the polls was getting maybe 9% of the vote, mm-hmm. and Putin was getting 65%. So he wasn't a real threat. But those numbers are very important for Putin as a source of his legitimation. Mm-hmm. I do not think, yes, that the mutiny by Prigozhin in June certainly was a moment of weakness and disarray on the part of the Kremlin. The guy got within 120 kilometers of Moscow. But I think the war has actually strengthened Putin. Not so much by augmenting the Kremlin's already formidable power than by radically diminishing the scope of civil society. I mean, until recently, political elites had a degree of decision-making power. And now the war has made them just into the executors of Putin's will. Mm. And Russian institutions can't serve as vehicles for questioning official policy. Many Russians accept the following propositions as doctrinal truths. Putin is capably fighting a necessary war. He's the only one who can lead Russia. He owns Russia's political future. Anyone who says anything different does it at risk. But I'd say that you never know. I mean, so far, the war has made Putin and Putinism stronger. But if the military, Russian military, should start to achieve something closer to victory in Ukraine, the Putinist system will become even more assertive at home and abroad. And if Putin even were to pass from the scene, the instruments of coercion will likely remain where he's planted them. So it's not clear. I should say that there is very likely very little enthusiastic support for the war. On the other hand, people support the war because they're loyal to their country. And being loyal to their country means being loyal to Putin. If Putin suddenly should say, we're getting out of this war, we're going to negotiate peace, even on bad terms, people would accept it too, because they're loyal to Putin. That's what I think.
And finally, Professor Tumarkin, what does Putin's victory mean for Russia and the world at large?
Which victory?
His election victory.
It means, it. You know, actually what it means for Russia, which is really very sad, that is not, we're not just looking at this point with this election at, oh, another 6-year term. I think it's not just a ritual exercise validating another 6 years, validating. It should be interpreted as a final farewell to those vestiges of the political past when there was some measure of freedom, some measure of press freedom, some measure of civil liberties, some measure of human rights, some measure of decency. I think it's really just a very dark and depressing and demoralizing vision. And for the world, it's just going to mean that this war is going to continue. Many people think that the war will continue as long as Putin remains in power. As we know, it's created, you know, sort of tectonic shifts in the war, in terms of food supplies that can't come from Ukraine, in terms of the vast expense of trying to help the Ukraine's army. But, you know, I think that in the end, I don't see how Ukraine can prevail against Russia. The sanctions have, the impact of Western sanctions have been virtually nil. The Russian economy is humming along extremely well and prospering. But it's possible that the victory might be in this election might be undermined if enough bodies come back. I mean, there are estimates that over 300,000 Russians have died so far in this war. And then who knows?
Professor Tumarkin, we really appreciate your insights. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it myself.
If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.